Good morning and welcome once again to More Food for Thought, the companion show for food conversations. And I'm here in the studio with my producer, Steve Corey. And once again, my guest is Tessa Wetherill. Tessa is the Young Agrarians land matcher for this part of the province. Welcome, Tessa.
Thank you very much, Warren. It's great to be back.
Lovely to have you here. Last week, we talked at length about Tessa's fascinating journey to the position she now holds, a journey that led her through more than one country. It led her through experiences with mentors who inspired her to get into the world of food production in a very serious way. And we're going to talk today about how those experiences have resulted in her taking on the position she's in now, which is a very important position and one of the few entry points for new farmers into farming in this part of the world. So Tessa, let's just do a little definition to start off. The definition of young agrarians and the land matching program itself. Maybe just describe it.
Sure. So the Young Agrarians in general, I mean, we're the largest ecological educational resource network for new and young farmers in Canada. So we offer farmer-to-farmer programming. Our whole mandate is just to grow the next generation of food growers. So sometimes we joke that we farm farmers.
It's not a bad joke. I think it goes down very well.
Yeah, that's Young Agrarians in general. And then the land matching program is specifically designed to address the issue of land access being the number one barrier for folks entering into the industry. So, you know, we live in this climate of some strong economic pressures around land and land as commodity. So in order for new farmers to access that land, we need to have some creative and innovative solutions to get people on land. And one of those solutions is leasing land. And so go ahead.
I was just going to say that the land matching program in BC is somewhat unique in the Canadian context. Not the only program, but it is quite well developed. It's modeled, as I understand, on a program that was started in Quebec. That's where the kind of basic principle was established.
Yes, it was. So there was the original land matching program in Canada developed in Quebec. It was called Lauterre. And our executive director, Sarah Dent, worked closely with them in developing a program that would meet the needs of British Columbians and new farmers in this part of the world.
Sure. And Sarah Denton, you mentioned her name. She began as a photographer, taking picture of farms.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting story. One day we'll maybe have her on the show to talk about that. It sort of illustrates the captivation that farming and growing food presents to people. It's such an important part of what happens to get food to us. It doesn't just grow on, I was going to say it doesn't grow on trees, but it does actually grow on trees. It just doesn't come out of the air magically and turn up on the supermarket shelves. So your beginning with Young Agrarians was very near the beginning of the organization itself in around 2013. And you went to one of the famous Young Agrarian mixers. Tell listeners what a Young Agrarian mixer is all about.
So it's really about networking. It's really about relationship development and getting to know people in the community who are doing things that you are doing. So we bring a whole bunch of folks together and we learn from each other and we talk. And the first one in the Okanagan was in 2013. And one of the sort of core foundational pieces of a mixer is the intro circle. And it really sort of defines the ethos of Young Agrarians, I think, well.
And it's so, actually a circle. It is importantly a circle.
Indeed. So no matter how many people are in the room, it can take a very long time, but it is key. We make sure this happens at the very beginning. So we get everybody in a circle, and it's a very powerful tool to ensure that everybody's voice is heard in the room. They're given an opportunity to introduce themselves, describe, you know, where they are and what they're doing, maybe offer a something that they have, an offering that they are wanting to share, or something that they need, and then usually something fun just to connect with people. And you wouldn't believe the kind of connections that happen in an intro circle. Like, babies have been made even from these types of situations. But, you know, it's like, I need a tractor, or I need a mentor, or I need an employee. And, you know, this kind of both resources, you know, material resources, educational resources, all these kinds of things, really connecting people. And
Was it a conscious borrowing from Indigenous meetings, or was it just, it seemed like the right thing to do?
Well, I mean, that would be a question for Sarah Dent, our executive director, who would be able to more accurately answer. You know,
the only reason I say that is because that is a basic principle of Indigenous communities. When there is a gathering, it's a circle. It's always a circle. We have squares. We have rows of people in, you know, one after the, like, schools, the industrial school model. But the circle is a very powerful thing, because you're facing, all facing towards each other and sort of revealing yourself in the process of the circle.
Yeah, indeed. There's a certain amount of vulnerability in those. I remember, yes, you know, years ago, they would make people a little bit uncomfortable, you know, and in order to sort of step outside yourself, it creates a deeper intimacy for the rest of the activities.
That's exactly what you want to have, a little vulnerability and more connection, more intimacy. They also feature food, surprisingly enough.
Of course.
And the food is good, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we would always have farmers donate vegetables and meat, and it would be prepared by local catering companies. And there's so much joy in sharing food. So that's another sort of foundational cornerstone of our organization and how we gather.
I think we need to make all the political systems in this country circles and have food. Let's approach the restructuring of the Houses of Parliament and see if we can make it work that way. One of the really important things... Yes, is networking, connecting. It's a beehive of interactions between people in all directions simultaneously. It reminds me of the way molecular change takes place in the cell. It's simultaneous and omnidirectional, and somehow Mother Nature makes it work perfectly, and human nature makes the meetings of young agrarians work perfectly as well. Now, the typical gathering, COVID has, of course, put a bit of a kibosh on that, but the typical gathering is actually quite large, between, say, 75 and 100 people. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, an annual mixer is a strong attraction for people from all over the province. So because they're typically held over a weekend, people are willing to travel and, you know, billet in people's homes and really make it a yearly event.
And it's a weekend, not just a single day, typically.
Yes. Yeah.
When we were talking about it before, you made the point that it is a way to keep people farming. It's kind of like an inspirational gathering where the contacts with other people and the interacting about, you know, who needs what and who would like what, that kind of thing, really, it motivates people to keep on going.
Yeah, I mean, I firmly believe that, you know, all things die in isolation. And so that connection to even the recognition that there is somebody else in the province who is struggling with the same issues that you are,
right,
it's enough. It provides nourishment. It's fortifying, and it helps you carry on. And, you know, it's also just a phone number. You can call somebody and, you know, have a conversation about what you're doing. And because so many of us are working in a rural context, and not all of us grew up in a rural context.
Yeah.
So coming from cities and then suddenly being faced with the very different challenge of living in an isolated rural area. And, you know, some people, even with successful farm businesses, that's what kills it. They're just like, well, you know, there's nobody here for me to be with.
you're tied to the land. It's a land-based activity, so you can't just wander off and do what you're doing in an office downtown and then come back home. You have to do it right on the land. We also talked about the fact that there are no extension services to speak of in BC, and they used to be a very prominent activity. And this, in a way, the work of the young agrarians takes on the role that the Extension Service is used to offer, which is that there's somebody to talk to who has some experience, can broaden your scope, can augment what you're doing, can support you, and can tell you what they're trying to do. It's sort of a replacement for the relatively non-existent extension for services.
Yeah, community as extension service is sometimes a little sentence that we use to describe what we do.
Sure, it makes perfect sense. Now, there are some schools for farming, but there's only, I believe, a couple in the province. Why don't you tell us about the Kwantlen and Tsawwassen programs?
Right. So these are programs that I believe were modeled off of the Linnea Ecological Farm Program, the program that I attended in 2007. And they are year-long programs where you're sort of fully immersed into the rhythm of a seasonal farm. And you can choose your area that you're interested in, whether it's animal husbandry or beekeeping or vegetable production. And you're sort of doing a combination of classroom studies as well as on-farm activities. And so there's one on the Tsawwassen First Nation land, and that's been running for, you know, I couldn't say exactly, probably 6 years or so. And that's a good foundational program for people to get a sense of, get some experience anyway.
Sure. It's probably worth saying a word or two about the Linnea Farm School, because that was such a crucial experience for you and for many other people who were sort of not sure but wanted to find out what farming was all about. That really did turn a corner for you, that and the person who was leading it, David Buckner. Just remind everybody about how important that was and what it allowed you and so many other young people to do.
Well, it certainly gave me a little bit of the technical know-how that I needed, but I would say more importantly, what it did was light a fire in me. And that was an inspirational fire and one that really led me to believe quite firmly that the most important work we can be doing right now is to protect and regenerate soil and water and biodiversity, and that those things are best done in intimate relationship with land.
Yes.
And what that means is that, you know, there's this sort of notion, somewhat popular, that the humanity that we're inhabiting is sort of a scourge on the earth. But actually, if we're positively participating with land, then that is a mutually healing activity. So, I mean, that's what I believe. And
Tessa for Prime Minister. Farming schools play an important role in a way, but we still don't have, and I just want to pause for a moment to focus on that, we still don't have a full, detailed, recognized certification program for farmers. And that, many people have spoken about that absence, the lack of something like that. What are your thoughts on that subject?
I think that is a genuine need. There are farming programs, but they are more typical programs for sort of larger scale conventional agriculture. The University of Guelph offers a lot of those programs. So what we're talking about is a different type of farming that is based on more ecological ideas and ideas of, like I'm describing, relationship, rather than sort of running a tractor over 5,000 acres.
That just gave me a little nightmarish vision. The program has experienced exponential growth, particularly with COVID. But why don't you just outline how that growth progress, which started out 3 years ago fairly slowly, but now has really picked up?
Certainly. So the BC Land Matching Program was launched as a sort of pilot project about 5 years ago. And then it was only 3 years ago in 2018 when we received funding through the Ministry of Agriculture to expand across British Columbia that it really sort of took on a new life. So that has allowed there to be land matchers like myself in five different regions across British Columbia. And initially we were just sort of doing outreach and trying to find out what are the needs of new farmers, what sort of how many landowners are interested in leasing out their farmland. And it turned out to be a great need. And we are now busier than we can imagine. It's very happy to be so busy, actually. But
You have a mailing list of 5,000, roughly.
I, roughly, yeah.
Yeah, that's astonishing. The other thing is that it's actually really resulted in very concrete results. How many acres of land have been turned into farmland as a result of the program?
Yeah, certainly. This is a very great stat to share. So there's 6,000 new acres put into production because of this program. And I love that personally, coming from a farming background, to have actual concrete evidence of the work that you're doing is incredibly rewarding for me. So
I think is rewarding for all of British Columbia. And in the 3 years program and its exponential growth has been facilitated in this case by some wise decisions in the Ministry of Agriculture to fund the program. How does that work? How does the funding work for the ministry?
I'm not the expert in the funding realm. I know very little about the money aspect of things. I'm on the ground with the people and on the land and in the relationships. But our Sarah Dent does some magic with them, and you know, is I started out as a contractor, and we've since developed enough stability with the program that I've become an employee. Right. And due to the success of the program, it does seem likely that it will carry on in the future. It does seem like a necessary resource for people and have really positive results.
And your contract is a yearly contract?
Yes.
So do you have to kind of bid for it, or how does that work? Do you have to come up with a justification? I know that you have to keep a lot of data because government programs thrive on data recording.
Yeah, we're certainly tracking all of our work. And that's important to tell the story. I mean, I love to tell the personal stories, but there's also a story that is told with numbers. And that's the kind of, you know, how many acres are in production and how many landowners are reaching out in which regions. And, you know, all of that is really important to share with people, you know, so that we have hard, concrete evidence to support the existence of such a service.
Yeah, there are a lot of bean counters keeping a steely gaze on what people do when they get paid by the government. So with COVID, things really went quite, you know, stratospheric. Talk about how that changed, how your inquiries changed.
Yeah, so at the beginning of COVID, what we experienced across the board was a astronomical increase in inquiries from folks that I would deem farm curious. So these are folks who don't necessarily have any farm experience, but have suddenly been woken up to the idea that this could be a good idea for them in their lives. So fielding those calls is always great because people are very excited. And so my role with them is to, well, first of all, to listen very carefully to, you know, what it is that they're excited about, and then to direct them to a resource. Perhaps they're not ready for the land matching program because there are some sort of goalposts that people need to sort of be a level that people need to be at in order to access the services of the land matching program, i.e. they need to have a certain level of experience and a business plan in place. We're invested in the long-term success of these relationships. We put a lot of energy into them. So we want to make sure that they're secure. However, those sort of beginning just people who are having dreams of leaving the city and ditching their job as a data analyst, I mean, we can encourage them down a certain path, you know, talk to this person, connect with this business, you know, have you read this book, you know, have you come out to a mixer? Those types of things will sort of move them down the path.
When we were discussing this before the show, the phrase marriage counseling came up, that the process of bringing a potential farmer and a landowner together is much more than just a contractual arrangement. It's also, as you described a moment ago, a lot of listening, a lot of questions, and some very specific concrete things that have to be set up. And it only works if you get, as you described it, a good vibe. You get a good feeling. The two people that you're bringing together have meeting of the minds on a multiple level. It's not just sort of a one-off kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very important. The relationship aspect is the part that will uphold the contract, right? I mean, we develop legal leases that are reviewed by lawyers, and it's great to have those in the just-in-case scenarios, not that they've ever arisen. But really what it is a document that is recording what it is that was agreed to, primarily because people have terrible memories. We've spent all this time getting to know one another, getting to share what our needs are from a really honest place. And they're sort of identifying what mutually beneficial terms can we write down in order to support the long-term relationship.
And in this process, there are specific documents that you use. One is an agreement checklist. What's the content of the agreement checklist, basically?
So the agreement checklist is 86 questions that covers everything from really high level, making sure that people's values are aligned, to really nitty gritty details like whose responsibility is it to turn off the tap and who's going to pay for the fence if it breaks, those types of, daily interactions. And then also sort of the hypothetical what ifs, which are often really uncomfortable. I mean, it's often my job to ask those sort of uncomfortable questions and put them out to people, like, what happens if you get a divorce and your business fails? Or what happens if, when you pass away, what will be the future of the land then? And, those are things that people don't necessarily want to talk about.
This reminds me of some conversations I have in my office as a family physician, asking the difficult questions in order to get the answers out in the open. Yes. And when you ask those questions, do you see people hearing or reading their answers and then coming to new insights as a result of just thinking about the questions?
Indeed, because I mean, a lot of people have avoided thinking about those things at all. So, I mean, I need to remember that there is, you need to allow people a certain amount of time, and there's some respect and grace that needs to be offered to people if they're sort of coming up against these questions of mortality, and sort of really imagining, like, okay, what is land? They're big, big questions. Like, how do we steward land, and what happens long term? I mean, it can be, big for people.
You've done fairly extensive training and taken extensive training programs through the Justice Institute on things like mediation and dispute resolution. That's been an essential part of working into this role. Tell us a little bit about that training program. You're actually going to graduate soon. I mean, have an official degree. So talk about the training program and what you're going to get out of it when you get your final degree, as it were.
Well, I mean, I've enjoyed those courses so much, and they're everything from negotiation and conflict resolution to sort of more technical things like civil procedure and, how mediation fits into the larger legal context. But I mean, foundationally, it is how do we talk to one another and how do we get along and how do we, get our needs met, and, how can one person support a group or, because we're often in situations where there's not just two stakeholders at a table, but multiple people, like children of retiring farmers. And there's a lot of emotional content that can come up in those situations. And I realized right from the get-go that, while I had this incredible knowledge of farming and agriculture, and that was my wheelhouse, I need to step into a bigger role as somebody who is capable of holding a space, and allowing for these conversations to take place in a productive way.
Sometimes asking questions is the best way to help somebody understand what they're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
What will your final degree actually be called when you are a professor, as it were, a professor?
Well, a certified mediator.
Certified mediator. And it's been a 3-year process, which is a long time to be working on something, but it gives you a lot of depth, I would presume.
Yeah, it's been a joy.
Yeah. Another tool that you use is called the Good Transition Toolkit. What's in that toolkit?
Sure. So the It's a non-family farm transition toolkit. And this was developed out of a need that we were hearing from people. So we're a grassroots organization, and all of what we develop comes from like people calling us up and being like, help, we don't
What do we do now?
So we're starting to hear a lot from farmers that they don't have succession plans, that they have spent their life developing this business and developing and pouring their lifeblood into a piece of land, and now there's no one to take it over. And if how can we support that, the transition of those businesses and land to the next generation outside of a family context where it's a straight up inheritance issue? I mean, that is the traditional model, that there is inherited land and there's already some capitalization on that land, and the children receive it and then, you know, carry on. So what happens when that is not possible? And, you know, what types of cooperation mechanisms can we put in place for these to happen? And so, yes, the transition toolkit goes quite in depth into, you know, how people might even begin thinking about this type of situation. So starting with something like setting your vision and then moving all along the timeline to, you know, an actual transition happening, a succession plan.
It almost sounds like a good model for people's thinking about their own lives in general. And and in fact, there are workbooks and programs that are designed to do just that, to get people to think about their lives in a sort of a holistic way and a very concrete way where things are going. It sounds like a marvelous approach and probably gets a lot of longtime farmers thinking very seriously about not just what to do with their land, but who they are and what they really think is important in life.
Yeah, I think one of the first things we do is we ask people to write their legacy letter. Like what do you
mean? And do you, when you offer that to say somebody's been farming for many years and just doing it, do you get some unusual responses sometimes? People sort of moved, very much moved.
Oh yeah. I mean, the transition toolkit will bring you to tears many times. It's not a dry document. It's there's a lot of aliveness in it, because what you're talking about is people's life stories and life work and their real foundational core values. And when people are thinking about setting the vision and the legacy for the next generations, I mean, it's very beautiful content.
My goodness. I have some very wonderful visions in my head as you describe this. So Tessa, that's the Good Transition Toolkit for farmers who are trying to explore the notion of their land staying as a farm and how to do that constructively. There's also, for new applicants who want to become farmers, a participant handbook. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that a bit.
So the participant handbook is another resource that we developed for the land matching program. And this is for everybody to sort of get a handle on the nuts and bolts and the regulatory frameworks that are involved when you start talking about land sharing. Because, I mean, to speak quite frankly, there's larger sort of structural antagonism towards a sort of small scale organic farmer. And there's, you know, regulatory and food policy structures that are not necessarily supportive. So how can we work around and, you know, enter into these situations and be aware of this context?
Could you give a couple of examples of some of the regulatory structural issues or processes that don't make it as easy as it should be for small farms to be established?
Sure. So, I mean, part of what we're dealing with is a system that was designed to support a certain type of farming, which was the, you know, classic, you know, say you've got a dairy and there's, you know, Farmer John and maybe Farmer John's part-time helper and his wife works off farm so that they can get some, you know, medical benefits or whatever. And they have a huge farm and all this equipment, and that's the model. Now, economically, that's not being feasible to pass on to the next generation. So what we need is more people involved. Mm-hmm. We need sort of cooperative elements. And part of that is like really, you know, we need more housing. So, you know, if you put another two houses on that property, then maybe you could have somebody who's running a dairy and you could have somebody who's, you know, growing herbs for tea, and you could have somebody who is running a once a week pizza oven, but there would be a collaborative element that would economically support the land and allow there to be more sort of restoration work that happens. And what that takes is tenure, right? You need land restoration is deep work. And so you need to be able to be secure in that to develop systems that will sustain long-term. So, you know, those are a couple issues, you know, tenure in leasing situations, sure, lack of housing or adequate housing for cooperative models to work.
The one thing that is underlying all that you're saying is that this is a process that takes time, because land, you can't rush the land. You can't make changes in plant life and animal life take place overnight. You have to give it time to evolve and develop. That's that sort of guides the process underlying.
Yeah, it does.
So when you have a new person phone up, you get about, I think you told me, about 10 calls a day these days anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of inquiries, both from landowners and new farmers.
And a lot of them in COVID times are what might be called dreamers. They're people who have a vision of what they would like to do, but they don't have a practical grounding at that point. Mm-hmm. And you bring them down to earth.
Very gently.
You said your primary method is to ask questions and let them percolate in the mind of the inquirer so that they have a sense of what they're actually up against, as opposed to what they imagine they're going to do or would like to do.
Yeah, we found that to be a very effective method of moving people into the direction of grounding into reality.
Is that the Justice Institute's ground? Does it drum it into you? Don't tell people what to think, ask them what they think and see what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mentality of curiosity. You know, sure. how can you maintain curiosity and you know, be very wondering about people's experience and what brought them there, and then, you know, they present with this big plan and you say, okay, well, like, you know, what would that look like in year one? Or, like, you know, I mean, sometimes you even have to ask the more pragmatic questions, like, what about the finances? Like, do you have $5,000 to build a greenhouse? Or, you know, what exactly are we working with?
An important part of the process also is going to the land. Going to the land, if somebody's offering land for use, going to see what's there, the land and things like buildings. That's an important part of what you do.
Yeah, so with when landowners call up and we have sort of over the phone assessed that both them and their properties would be suitable for the program, the next step would be to go out and do a site visit. And that involves doing some sort of agricultural assessment for, you know, what would serve this land best and what is this land asking for? Is there water there? Is there fencing? Is there infrastructure that could be used? And we're sort of putting together a whole picture of what is there, and then what is the vision for the landowner? What do they want to see happen? And that's important.
And sometimes when you go, you're surprised by what you see, both positively and negatively. What kind of, maybe you could give it a couple of examples of what you've landed on when you actually go out and do a land visit.
Well, hopefully there aren't too many surprises, because we would have, you know, if somebody calls up and says they have, you know, a forested north-facing slope and it's about, you know, 0.5 of an acre and they'd like to get farm status, you know.
Things like buildings, though, can be sometimes, they're important, as you said earlier, they're important on the land.
Certainly. I mean, you know, a lot of the people that are starting new farms are attracted to vegetable production, as you know, is also my background. And mm-hmm. The reason for that is because you can launch a business with relatively little infrastructure and start to cash flow that little business right away. Whereas, you know, things like meat production and that requires more equipment, more infrastructure is a little bit more challenging.
The arrangement, the financial arrangement, occurs between a landowner and the person who is leasing it, or whatever arrangement is made to be able to use it. can be very variable. The amount of money that changes hands can range very widely. Maybe you could just talk about the sort of the limits, the plus and the minus limits in that sort of arrangement.
Yeah, when we have the conversations about financial exchange, what we're really talking about is value exchange. Right. What value is flowing in which direction? So, you know, perhaps it is of incredible value for the landowner just simply to see that there is food production happening on their land. And that is all that they want. And that is giving them all that they need. Hmm. That maybe that the plus of you know, having farm tax classification and paying a little less taxes. And in that case, they would be willing to offer the land at you know, for no money. Mm. And so it's really unique. Every contract that we create is unique. So it depends on the needs of the people. And it is good for there to be a financial exchange. You know, there's a range land, you know, I work in the South Okanagan often with vineyards, and those are larger, more successful economic enterprises, and they have the capacity to pay. And so, you know, their maybe land is going for up to $3,000 per acre per year. Hmm. Even that though, it's not an incredible amount of money. It's actually quite reasonable when you compare it to what you would be paying to buy that land. And so I mean, that's another reason why land leasing is becoming more and more normative, because economically it's just making more sense.
Land leasing, what would be the basic ingredients in a land leasing contract? What were sort of key components that make it work?
Well, I mean, what makes it work? People make it work. Hmm. The terms that are critical are, you know, how long, how much, what, where.
Sure.
Yeah.
In terms of length of contracts, because obviously land is a specific, you can't really call it a commodity. It's our life source. So what's the average length of a lease holding or a contract? I'm sure it varies a lot, but what's sort of an average?
Well, it's everywhere from 1 to 29 years in my experience. 29 years is the longest amount of time that you can have a lease without incurring property transfer tax. Oh. So that's the limit there. But people could also pay the property transfer tax and have a longer lease than 29 years.
Right.
You know, what we want is stability and security long term. That's the whole goal of these contracts. But, you know, some folks are willing to sort of have a shorter term agreement because they're just kind of testing the waters. Both parties are in agreement that, you know, this is an experiment. So they want to give it, you know, two seasons or so before they right. really sign on long term. But what you're mentioning, Warren, about land as commodity is really, it's an interesting idea, because we still have that embedded culturally in the way that we interact with land. And, you know, that's why, you know, land leasing is just one way around that. We work with other organizations like BC Foodlands Cooperative, which are land trust organizations working now in the context of agricultural land, because there is a need for that to be protected, and to sort of emancipate land from the commodity market could be a really powerful tool and allow these types of, you know, farmers to do the work that they need to do.
Do you sense that in entities like land trusts, there are a number of land trusts around BC and Canada and all over the place, that they're now understanding that agricultural land properly handled is a key element? It's not just keeping a wetland or a forest area, but it's also that interface between humans and the natural world, which is what farmland essentially is. It's a key interface because it produces benefit for humans, and it produces, if it's done right, benefit for the land and for natural elements in the land. That there's increased recognition of that?
I would hope that that's happening, and I think that it is, Warren. I mean, that to me, that's the idea of reciprocity, and that's something that people are thinking about a lot more. The traditional conservation method of, like, cordon it off and don't touch it is one way. But I mean, like I mentioned right at the beginning of our conversation, that participation, like human participation, can be so powerful in that mutual healing. And it goes both ways. I think it's arrogant to assume that we're going to come in and and heal the land. I mean, I wouldn't be the person that I am without spending 12 years with my hands in the dirt. I mean, it healed me like on so many deep levels, and that's the relationship that needs to be developed, that listening.
And from your mentors, the two key mentors that come to my mind from our last conversation are Vince McIntyre and Dave Buckner. Their spirits and their perspective is somewhat antithetical towards this commodity-based approach to land. They would see it as kind of a living part of people's lives.
Mm-hmm. And also very grounded in interaction with other people, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also about the relationships and the people who are also involved in the harvest or shared workload.
This is a very important evolution from an approach that was popular maybe 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, which said that humans are destructive on the land and there's no way that human, you know, if we got rid of, you still hear it from time to time, if we just got rid of all the humans, you know, the planet would heal and everything would be fine. And yet what you're working on is very definitely making it clear how humans can restore land, can make it functions for the benefit of humans, but also in a way that enhances natural values as well. It's interesting how much of the land, you said that, first of all, there's more land available than there are farmers to farm it. So there's a building up process going on, but also that most of the land has never been farmed before. And sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe not never, but it's, yeah. It's
not for a long time.
For long periods of time.
And so there's a restorative process that's going on here as well, mm-hmm. that you're engendering that kind of process. Do you just comment about that a little bit? Because that, I think, is a key concept in the work you're doing.
Well, I think it's like I was talking about before. That's the idea of regeneration and taking time to establish systems that will be helpful for both the long-term benefit of the people and the land. It takes tenure and time and a lot of hard work.
And then you get something good at the end of it. So Tessa, the process of land matching is moving ahead. It's expanding. There's all sorts of changes taking place. Just briefly, describe what you do in a given day. Obviously, with a very busy service, you have some very busy days. How does it go? What's a typical day for you?
Well, I'm engaged with people very deeply. So whether that's by email or on the phone or going out to a farm and checking it out, there's people sort of at every stage of the process, and I'm kind of nurturing those people along a certain path. So, you know, right now, for example, I have about 7 different relationships contracts that are in different stages. So, you know, that's, we're moving towards that completion point of having a lease signed. Mm-hmm. Although that's never the end. There is sort of an aftercare component of what we do, and the program's been running 3 years now, so I'm certainly now getting calls from folks that were matched in past years and needing a little bit of support in either amending their lease or some relationship repair that needs to happen. You know, it's human
interactions of the same complex nature that occur in every part of the world. When you have completed a lease, there's a sort of a signing ceremony that takes a ceremony, maybe it's not quite the great word, but a signing action. And what's that like?
Oh, I was just talking about this yesterday with our program manager, Darcy Smith, because we haven't been doing the meetings to facilitate the signing. We've been doing it on an e-signature platform since COVID.
Right.
And we've noticed that people are not, like, they just forget to sign or whatever. There isn't a sort of completion point where we take photos and, you know, sign the papers we were just saying that we were really wishing for that to start up again, because it gives people a sense of I think it's important to have little rituals around when we do important
and there'd be so much work has been put into bringing it to this point of fruition for not only the people who are signing the lease arrangement, but also for you as the manager, the nurturer of this process. Pretty satisfying.
Yeah, it is.
Well, maybe there'll when COVID settles down, we'll have pictures all over the place on the front pages of publications everywhere. One of the things we talked about briefly, and it is an important feature of establishing a lease, and that is, what kind of place do you live in? Do you live in an auxiliary home? Do you live in the main home that's on the land, etc.? Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because it's a very concrete issue that often is not on the table initially. People who are looking at this kind of leasing arrangement haven't necessarily thought about it all that well.
Right. I mean, I think you're pointing to what I mentioned earlier about one of the sort of barriers and issues that we deal with in the land matching program, which is about housing. So, I mean, ideally, a farmer would be best served and the land would be best served by their constant presence on the land. And, you know, a lot of the land that comes into the database is sort of the traditional scenario where there's X amount of acres and one farmhouse. And so the land owners are living in that farmhouse. And then, you know, then we're having situations where lessees, new leasing farmers, are either commuting from somewhere that where they're renting in town, or they're perhaps sort of living on the land in an RV or something, which is technically not legal. So there's some instability and insecurity in that. It's significant.
There have been some
recent changes to ALR policy to allow for secondary housing on ALR land. And this is a really amazing change that we're going to see happen, part of the Bill 52, which was released, will be repealed now. So there will be more flexibility and hopefully more opportunities for secondary housing on farmland.
So the barrier was established, let's call it a barrier, was established in the past because it was thought it would limit the amount of housing construction on agricultural land. But there was no perception, presumably, at that time, that there could be a family or an individual or group of individuals leasing land from the farmer in order to make it continue to be a farm while the farmhouse was still present itself. The original farmhouse was still present. That was the original spirit, was it?
It was, of course. I mean, that it was put in place to protect farmland. I don't know the exact statistic for Canada, but in America, 70% of all farmland is owned by folks over 65. And I would imagine it's something quite similar in Canada.
I believe it is, yes.
So, you know, then we're at 65 plus, you're not having necessarily the energy to, you know, start new projects and build and restore and regenerate. So, you know, how can we bring in that new energy on the land and have everybody suitably housed and comfortably cooperating in positive system change?
Yes. It's interesting, within the city limits of Salmon Arm, it's only a few years ago that secondary housing in order for young people to take care of elderly parents or other relatives was established. And it's kind of ironic that it's taking longer to have, I mean, it's now happening, but it's taken a long time for this secondary housing to be established in farms, even though land with people, you can defer, you know, interactions until the moment is convenient. But with the land, if something's going on, you have to actually be right there and deal with it. It's often something it can't wait. Irrigation or, you know, pest degradation, that kind of stuff. You have to address it quickly. Going on to the general process, as we're kind of moving towards the end of the program, there's some principles that have emerged in our conversations last time and this time, and also prior to both shows. And one is that there are some key features that seem to be part of everything you've been talking about. One is relationships, the relationship between farmer and landowner is, of course, central to the work you do as a land matcher. And then networking. In other words, this broad swirl of interactions that goes on. It goes on at the Young Agrarians Mixers in a very concentrated process, but it's going on all the time. And a third element that strikes me is pragmatism. You know, you've got to have a home to live in. You've got to make sure that the land is working right. Could you just kind of tie those things a little bit together, relationship networking and the pragmatic nature of what you have to do? This is a David Buckner question.
I'm already scratching my chin.
Yes. Was that what he would do? He'd scratch his chin when he was starting to...
The distance, stare at the horizon for a good long while.
I like the man. I've never met him, but I won't be able to now because he's not with us anymore, but he sounds like a wonderful guy.
Yeah, I mean, all of those components are so key for the success of what we're trying to do here. And, you know, they complement one another, you know, that yes, you need to have an economically viable business. And that's one of those very pragmatic pieces. And that business needs to be situated in a network and a community of people who are going to support you. And that network is relationship. So, I mean, it's kind of like nesting dolls. You know, I see it as it's all sort of coiled up and we need to explore all of those things in order to meet the mandate of having a next generation of food growers.
The next generation of food growers is facing a complex situation. There's two competing forces. One is large-scale, distantly grown food crops that are transported vast distances in large quantities, in which, in fact, quantity is the dominant characteristic. There's lots of it coming on the ship or in the truck from Mexico, from New Zealand, etc. And then there's this new model, which is really an old model. It's a return to an old model with some changes. And that is local, small scale, intimately connected agricultural activities within and or near a community. Can you talk about your take on that exchange or that transition point that we're in and what it seems like to you?
Yeah, well, one of the things we talked about before, Warren, is why and how is it that people change? And what is it that motivates people to interact with the world in whatever way they're going to interact? And I believe that, you know, if we can envision a more beautiful world, then we can work towards that. And how does that feel? Like, what will it feel like to eat? What will it taste like? It needs to be based in a positive, pleasurable experience. And I think that people are more and more realizing that is offered by this sort of small is beautiful model rather than the bigger is better mentality that we've sort of been indoctrinated with. So that's my hope, really.
It is a time of turmoil in that respect. The two paradigms, if you like, are competing. I think it's fair to say that the small, local, intimate kind of arrangement with relationships and networking key is becoming, it's coming on. It's coming on stronger. And the model that's only about 40 or 50 years old anyway, of vast distances, somewhat exploitation of workers who grow food, it's not working very well. It's based on fossil fuels. It's based on global interactions rather than local interactions. Do you have a sense of hope as you see, as you are embedded in this work?
Yeah, I do. I do. I mean, I think that, you know, people often say that, you know, well, be realistic because we've got to feed the world, you know. So yeah, it's kind of nice to indulge rich people and their fetish for like ethical, fancy food. But like, you know, when it comes right down to it, how are we going to, you know, we've got a huge population. And, you know, it depends on what you believe progress is. And, you know, it is actually more efficient. You can grow more calories per acre in this way, but it is less efficient if you're talking about units of labor, right? So it's like, what is, how do you want to interact with land? I mean, is it progress to take people and their connection with the soil out of it, and have them sort of like in their air conditioned tractors, so sort of going around? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we're coming to the end of our show. And I don't want to end without thanking you very much, Tessa, for bringing, I think, an enlightened and practical perspective on the growing of food. I think our listeners have learned a great deal. Certainly, I think I find it just as inspiring as I think they do. So thank you once again as we work towards this, as you said, believing in a better world. Thank you.
My pleasure. Bye, Warren.